Welcome to Countersign. This is Stuart Motha. Countersign is a podcast where we discuss books, films, and other materials with their authors and creators. This is its fourth series. You can catch up on previous series wherever you get your podcasts or on countersignisapodcast.com. You can follow us on Twitter or Instagram. We welcome your feedback. Richard A. Lee Jr. is a professor in the Department of Philosophy at DePaul University in Chicago. I first met Rick at the International Symposium in Phenomenology in Perugia. I was immediately struck by the extraordinary range of his thinking as he works on medieval and early modern philosophy at the Frankfurt School and political philosophy. Although disguised as an American, he's a sort of Renaissance figure, reading his Aristotle in Greek, his Aquinas and Duns Scotus in Latin, and his Adorno in German. He's also part of a trio of philosophers who convene the immensely fun and hugely creative Hotel Bar Sessions podcast, which I certainly recommend. Rick's book, which serves as the focus of our discussion, is The Thought of Matter, Materialism, Conceptuality, and the Transcendence of Immanence, published by Roman and Littlefield in 2016. Although I have given this episode of Countersign the title What is the Matter with New Materialism, that is not the primary focus of Rick's book. There has, however, been an explosion of discussions of materialism, including the speculative realism and materialism of Quentin Meursault and various other new materialisms associated with Bruno Latour, Graham Harman, and others. These discussions serve as a backdrop to a more urgent and trenchant methodological and metaphysical problem. If matter is not reducible to thought, that is, matter is the other of thought, then how can this matter be thought without drawing away from its materiality? If we accept the alterity of matter to thought, then we need to delve into the philosophical problem of how we have access to things in the world. While we can experience things by way of sensations, that doesn't give an account or knowledge of the conditions by which things are presented to thought. Why does this philosophical problem of holding matter and thought apart and examining how matter is presented in and through thought matter in a time of global climate destruction and the time of the Anthropocene, especially when various new materialisms have been deployed to build connections between phenomena and things that have hitherto been treated as an inert backdrop to a human-centered perception of the world? My sense of the importance of the philosophical problem of the relationship between thought and matter is driven by a frustration with the treatment of matter by various new materialisms, which give me a sense that there is a new empiricism that is taking hold. And while the decentering of the human and the association of vibrancy and agency to things is a welcome move in philosophy and political theory, there is a difficulty of developing ethical and normative commitments from a mere empirical set of observations. Even when these are expressed as a regime of affects, it is difficult to discern an ethical or normative stance in relation to the explosion of connections drawn between various things or materialities. I believe Rick's book, The Thought of Matter, helps us with the philosophical groundwork for a materialism from which such ethical and normative commitments can be developed. The metaphysical problem of the encounter between thought and matter is investigated through Aristotle, Marx, Adorno, Althusser, Duns Scotus, Hobbes, and Walter Benjamin. While Rick moves through all these thinkers with an admirable dexterity, I was especially struck by his treatment of Adorno and the sense of thinking as a thinking of something, that thinking has a relation to an object which comes as a sort of second step. And the explanation he gives of Adorno's negative dialectic in relation to Hegel's dialectic, where Adorno refuses an absolute truth and maintains a separation between object and thought. In a beautiful chapter at the end of the book on Adorno and Benjamin, Rick reads Benjamin's thesis on the philosophy of history, and especially the second fragment and the phrase, "I am awaited." We discuss how this phrase encapsulates a hope of the past, of something being otherwise, a thought that is entirely apt for the time of environmental and climate catastrophes, and what may be a future anterior, a hope for another future. Professor Richard Lee, welcome to Countersign. I was delighted to read your book, The Thought of Matter, Materialism, Conceptuality, and the Transcendence of Immanence. And part of my excitement was about encountering somebody who was unashamedly defending a metaphysical philosophy in the face of all kinds of assaults by speculative realists and new materialists. And what is doubly interesting about your book is that you're obviously very familiar with that literature and other post-structural philosophies. So it's not that you're shutting a part of the library away. It's that you are insisting that your bit of the library is the one that is more aptly philosophical. So you're a thinker of materialism, but not a new materialist. What is the difference, and why does this difference matter?
So as I take it, new materialism, and we should acknowledge that this is a really broad category, and there are a lot of thinkers who fall under this umbrella. So it goes anywhere from Cantemi-Sue's speculative realism through Graham Harman's object-oriented ontology. There are a number of feminist theorists and political theorists. And especially in the age of the Anthropocene, people who are thinking about global climate catastrophe sort of look back at the history of philosophy and recognize that it's always been at some distance from matter and the material world, from nature and the natural world. And so they want to have a return back to materialism and get away from what Miesu calls reflexivity or reflectivity in philosophy, so that philosophy is just reflecting on the world, and they want to get back to the real world. And I appreciate that need, and I especially appreciate it in the acute crises which we find ourselves in daily in terms of the natural environment and other catastrophes. But philosophically, I find the move to be a little bit too quick. That is, I began wondering when I set out on this project, how can I just simply make the claim that there's stuff out there and we need to start thinking about the stuff without also thinking about the thinking about the stuff? And so my materialism wants to take on both sides, namely, what is this matter that we're talking about in materialism, and what is the thinking that's going on in this thinking that is materialism?
Yeah. So I think that's helpful because there's a sense clearly that people like Miyasu are also pursuing a reality that they are trying to think about. But the reality in their case, and particularly in Miyasu's case, is prior to thinking. So there's this notion of the ancestral that Quentin Miyasu talks about. And there is a alterity. It's a term that you also use. There's an alterity to the reality that they try to encounter. But then I think in the critique that you offer, particularly at the beginning of your book, The Thought of Matter, there's a sort of substitution that takes place where science is deployed in the place of thinking about thinking. And my sense of your book is that you're more attentive to the business of thinking about thinking. Would that be correct?
Yeah, and that's mostly because I began to see, the more I looked into how it is we could characterize materialism and how materialist philosophy would proceed, I began to see that many of the thinkers that I became most interested in were offering a version of materialism as a critique or having critical potential. Mm-hmm. And if, as this sort of archefact, which Miyasu also uses this term, you talked about the ancestral, if this is simply posited in advance of thought, then as given in a kind of immediacy, there's no moment for critical reflection on that givenness. Mm-hmm. And I'm enough of an unrepentant Marxist to know that immediacy is the thing we should always worry about. Mm-hmm. And even immediacy is mediated. And so I began getting interested in how, even if there is this sort of brute ancestral artifact, how it is that that's mediated to us and for us.
Yes, and we'll come back to the mediation of immediacy. I think that's a really important point that you make when you discuss Marx in your book. And I also wanted to acknowledge that you're quite right, of course, that there are many kinds of new materialisms, and part of the attraction of it, in the sense in which it's a kind of scholarly fashion at the moment, is that it does seem to respond to the ecological crises, the feminist critiques of a human-centered philosophy, and so on. But I think I'm also particularly interested in the ethical bite and the critical bite that your account of materialism contains. So let's go back to the beginning of the book, and you explain how the problem of thought and matter is one that arises for you when you started to think about Hobbes as a materialist thinker. Mm-hmm. Now, as a lawyer, as a person who works with political philosophy, of course, Hobbes is, for me, primarily someone I know through his book Leviathan. Mm-hmm. But I think you're focusing on a different text. So I thought you might start off telling us about the materialism of Hobbes and how that prompted you to think about thought and matter.
So I'm nothing if not a metaphysician. And so, of course, I'm not drawn primarily to Hobbes as a political thinker, but I started looking at his, what might be considered his metaphysics, which is actually, as in many philosophers of the period, is really a physics. This is, if you're familiar with the Leviathan, this is material that comes up in the first few chapters where mm-hmm. he talks about sensation and how sensation happens, how ideas are produced from sensation, and then how affects are produced from those ideas. And that the state of affects is what ultimately brings us to the right of nature, and then ultimately to the first law of nature. So, and now we're only like 20 pages into the Leviathan. But in another text, and this is called the De Corpore, or On the Body, Hobbes lays out at great length everything that's involved in those first five or six chapters. And so he goes more carefully through sensation and how sensation happens, he goes more carefully. Well, he doesn't go all the way to ideas, because that for him belongs specifically to The Human, which is another book in the same project. This was a trilogy. Mm-hmm. And so it's a much more detailed presentation of his basically materialist account of what we might call knowledge or epistemology. But I became confused because he opens that with a discussion of method and philosophy in general. And reason comes to play an important role in that discussion for him. So that reason is required in order for philosophy to proceed, because on his account there, philosophy's not just sensation. Mm-hmm. Something more has to happen in order for this to be considered philosophy, something like reflection. And when I began to look at his discussion of and definition of reason, it occurred to me that he has no materialist account of that capacity at all. Mm-hmm. And so my first thought was, is this just a contradiction in Hobbes? And I kind of got stuck with my project on Hobbes, trying to figure out whether this is a contradiction or whether one could be consistent and say, on the one hand, everything that exists is matter. And on the other hand, the way in which we understand that position, the way in which we understand the operation of nature, and the way in which we can come to formulate that position, all of that is not produced by Hobbes on any materialist grounds whatsoever. So he's not a neuroscientist like some new materialists tend to revert back to neuroscience. He's unwilling to go there, even though he's willing to go to neuroscience, at least in a rudimentary way, for many of his other investigations into other human capacities. And so the whole project sort of arose out of my confusion about how could this be.
Okay, and this is a really useful starting point. And I think the next thing to sort of put to you, the description of the difference between the natural world, the embodied, and the understanding of the natural world and embodiment would usually be stated and dismissed as Cartesian dualism. So you've probably heard this one before. And so I wanted to ask you to tell us about your metaphysical account of this duality. Is it a repetition of a Cartesian division of mind and body?
I don't know if you're aware of this, but when Descartes wrote the Meditations on First Philosophy, he gave it to his friend, Marie Mersenne. Mersenne was in touch with a lot of famous philosophers at the time, including Hobbes. And Descartes asked him to send it out and get their responses to it. Mersenne sent it to Hobbes. They were close friends, and Hobbes even wrote a section of one of Mersenne's books. So Hobbes responds and precisely critiques Descartes for putting forward a notion of thought that is disembodied. Hmm. And so there he puts forward an incredibly materialist form of philosophy, and heavily reliant on the neuroscience of his day, and which the neuroscience of the day was much more physical, I think, than it is today. There wasn't an understanding of electricity involved in the functioning of the brain. There wasn't an understanding of chemical relations that are central to the functioning of the brain. So he does put forward a materialist understanding of thought. But what he does in this other work is he is reflective of, if I could speak like a philosopher for a moment, what are the conditions for the possibility of my offering a materialist account? Mm-hmm. What has to be the case in order for me to offer a materialist account? And those conditions themselves, as he outlines them, are not themselves necessarily material. And this was a position that I thought was compelling, and started looking around for other examples of thinkers offering a similar position. Because as I put it in the book, if I just say there's matter, that it predates, pre-exists, maybe preconditions thought in relation to it, there's a simple positing there of matter that when we get down to brass tacks is not unlike the positing of the existence of God or gods. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of brute positing of matter as a kind of there-ness starts to look under critical pressure a lot like theology.
Mm-hmm. A lot like theology, and also possibly a lot like a new emboldened empiricism. I mean, would that be a fair assessment as well?
Yeah, a new and emboldened, and I mean, I don't want to step on anyone's toes here, but from a certain perspective, naive empiricism. Mm-hmm. Because of its positing of matter, is uninterested in a critical reflection on how what it is we might call knowledge, even knowledge of the material world, might be conditioned by other factors than matter, social factors, political mm-hmm. factors, legal factors, and so on. And I find that new materialism often doesn't provide us with the tools to engage in that critical reflection on how it is that even our empirical knowledge of the empirical world might be conditioned by something that is not empirical nor material.
Mm. I think new materialists would possibly meet that criticism by saying that what you have just articulated is a kind of sociocentrism, which is to say that when you're looking at the conditions of something in the world, you go to some kind of social cause of it rather than dwell in the thing in itself, which is what and the agency and the vibrancy, etc., of the thing in itself. And that is what many new materialists see themselves as doing. I was also struck about the kind of critical orientations in your book. And one of the examples that stick in my craw, you might say, is the example of the difference between eating and digesting a chicken and whether eating a chicken is good. An example I think you draw from Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. And so what I wondered then was whether your thinking of the relationship between thought and matter is then closer to a normative philosophy that you make distinctions between is and ought, and whether that is another lacunae of new materialism, where that ethical dimension of taking a normative position becomes more difficult when there is this, and we are maybe being too crude here, a kind of emboldened empiricism at play.
If I could just address briefly your retort from the new materialist perspective, one of the things that struck me in working on the book and continues to strike me is the way in which non-material entities appear in my experience as if they were things. And just to give one example that is particularly pertinent to us here in the U.S., at the time and since our founding, race is such a thing that if I look at what biologists tell us, and even what philosophers who have been spending the last 75 years or more thinking about this concept tell us, race doesn't exist. There isn't something you can point to and say that's race. Mm-hmm. But it does appear, to borrow a phrase from the American philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce, it appears in our world like a kind of stuck door against which you press your shoulder. It has a thingness there, mm-hmm. and yet it doesn't have a material existence. And so my vision of materialism as a kind of critical reflection would also be a materialist thought of these kinds of structures, even though they're social. Mm-hmm. And thinking social broadly here to also include the political and also the judicial, because mm-hmm. the judicial has a huge function in the reality of race in the United States, you know, throughout history, including today. And so this sort of gets to your second point. I don't know that I make a distinction between is and ought, But I am convinced that philosophy and maybe theory in general is normative all the way down. Mm-hmm. And so even when I say I'm a metaphysician and I'm an unrepentant metaphysician, I'm not acting as if I'm getting outside of normativity to find a level of reality that is not normative. And then the normative levels like ethics and then politics and aesthetics would be built on this foundation, especially for the thinkers like Adorno, Benjamin, and Marx and Louis Althusser, who I discuss in the book. For them, this critical capacity of materialism is required in order to show that metaphysics is normative all the way down. Mm-hmm. And so that leads me to agree with you that that claim is built on a much larger claim, and I think we might want to proceed slowly here, yes. but ultimately it relies on some claim about justice in general, I would say. But I use a vocabulary coming from the Frankfurt School tradition, which isn't justice, but we'll talk about this later, I think. Mm-hmm. But I really do think that there's something like the good that the critical materialists, if I can call them that, that I look at in the book, they're always thinking in the name of and in light of this kind of good or the good.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's great. And we'll certainly come to Althusser, Adorno, and Benjamin in this conversation. So to get to the kind of crux of your argument, you say that matter exists outside thought. Matter is not given by thought, but matter, being other than thought, needs to be thought. And you say, for example, that Merceau and other speculative realists don't quite tackle this problem of matter being outside of thought, but also needing to be thought. So how do you go about a materialist philosophy of how to think matter outside of thought? And to put it simply, doesn't matter wind up inside thought again?
Yes. So the short answer obviously is yes, it does end up inside thought again. But for me, the crux of the issue is, what does thought look like when it takes account of the otherness to it that it is attempting to think? And so to approach it a little broadly for a second, if thought is attentive to the otherness of what it is thinking, then it will always open a space for that otherness simply to be otherness. Mm-hmm. Because any attempt to think it, which I do accuse several new materialists of doing, any attempt to think it, I think actually does turn the materiality of material things into their thinkability. And mm-hmm. that's what I'm trying to refuse. And the new materialists say they're trying to refuse that, but I'm not convinced of it. And in fact, I don't want to go into make this an entire conversation about my mm-hmm. criticism of particularly Merceau and maybe Graham Harman, but I think that there's a way in which they're not understanding the fact that they really are just reflecting on matter. And you know, you pointed to some characteristics that many new materialists want to look at in relation to matter, like the vibrancy of its agency. Mm-hmm. You know, all of that, these are all concepts, and these are all concepts that are produced by thought in mm-hmm. thinking matter. And I don't want to pretend that they're not, lest we efface the alterity of matter altogether.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I should say at this point, and give a plug to your great podcast that you host with your co-host, Hotel Bar Sessions, which has a terrific episode on materialism, which I would highly recommend. So in getting to explaining matter as non-thought, you work your way through Aristotle and Aquinas as a philosopher of medieval thought as well. And I thought a useful kind of opposition to bring into conversation with those philosophers is the distinction between the ideal and the material, which we obviously see in Marx as well, and Marx's critique of Hegel. So I wondered whether you might want to sort of build the conversation that you engender through these philosophers in relation to the distinction you make between what is thought and matter as non-thought.
So following up from your plug for my podcast, let me plug the fact that you were a guest on one of our episodes speaking about the rights of nature, our title, not yours,
yes,
because it was mostly a discussion about why this is the wrong way to think about nature. Yeah. And this is obviously a related subject to to what we're talking about now. One way to put it, and one of my co-hosts, Lee Johnson, helped me to see this, is there is a way in which philosophy, and again, maybe all theory, but philosophy is always running the risk of an idealism. And it's always running the risk of an idealism because from its inception, either in Greece or in ancient China or in ancient India, in all of the places where it had its origin, it always is an attempt to figure out what is going on with the world that is given around us, how that world operates, what are the rules and conditions of its operation, what are the relationships among things. And ultimately, in almost every philosophical tradition, this is couched in terms of a question about living well, or at the very least, living better. And because of that reflection on the world that is given, you could already begin to see that there's a kind of retreat away from the world that's given to us. And that retreat, you just take like another step and a half, and you're right on the brink of saying thought constitutes the world, or the reality in which we find ourselves, which I would take to be like a full-blown idealist position. And I think in many ways, Marx reads Hegel as holding this position that the world is constituted by our thought. And so I recognize the idealist tendency that philosophy has, but I think that that idealist tendency is best met not by running in the opposite direction, because I'm always worried that, like, if you're on the other side of the coin, you're still on the same coin. And so I worry that we, in order to critique idealism and present a philosophy that is non-idealistic, one has to brush up against and run very close to idealism. And, you know, Marx has these cryptic ways that people refer to over and over again. You know, the famous thing about, you know, turning Hegel on his feet or on his head, and the essential kernel of the Hegelian dialectic. I think Marx is a thinker who saw that the real counter to Hegel's idealism is not going to be the direct opposite of it, but something that takes it quite seriously. And to borrow a phrase from Adorno, is an imminent critique of that philosophy. And the goal there is to then deploy thought or think in such a way that the other of thought can come to appear in its otherness from thought within thought.
No, that's really helpful. The other important thinker that you refer to in the book is, of course, Althusser. And you draw on Althusser to explain the trace of the distinction between essential and inessential in the process of abstraction. The essential is what knowledge is of. This seems to be another expression of the alterity of matter in the process of representation. So I'd like you to sort of explain that a bit further and to also ask, what, if anything, is politically at stake in drawing out this trace? Especially for Althusser, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I've been reading Althusser since graduate school, which is a couple of years ago or so. but I expect, I knew I should engage Althusser in this investigation into materialism. But what I had in mind initially was his essay on the materialist dialectic. Mm-hmm. Yet I found this section from reading Capital to be, well, first of all, for me, a more intelligible expression of many aspects of Althusser's thought. I admit to not understanding much of what Althusser says because he has an idiosyncratic vocabulary, and I'm not always even sure what the point, the problem is. Mm-hmm. But I did find this discussion of what on the face of it looks like what one might call essentialism in a more or less, let's say, Aristotelian sense. Mm-hmm. That is, that Aristotle has this metaphysics in which there are accidents like color and size and place and relations and so on. But these accidents, as the name or incident might be a translation of that as well, as those names imply, are not the reality of the thing. There's something real that underlies that. And so I am real independent of being 5 feet 11. I am real and independent of having blue eyes. And so there is, as Althusser puts it in this gesture, a kind of scraping off mm-hmm. of the inessential, the mm-hmm. accidental, in order to get at the reality, the essential. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason why he calls this empiricism, I came to realize after I wrote the book, is that in many ways, any empiricist philosophy has to engage in a similar kind of operation, because one of the problems that every empiricist knows, going back even before Hume, is that while what I sense might be something like color, I never say, oh, here I'm looking at my screen and I'm sensing this blob of color. I say I'm seeing Stuart. Mm-hmm. And so what they have to account for the difference between what one might call the matter of sensation and what is sensed. Mm-hmm. And I think there Althusser sees a similar scraping off operation where one has to scrape off what is inessential to get at then, no, I'm actually seeing the thing. I'm touching the thing. Even though I do that through these accidental characteristics, qualities is what they generally come to be called in the modern period. What he sees there is that the very designation of the essential and the inessential is itself already a normative moment. Mm-hmm. That is, how do I know in advance what is the essential and what is the inessential? When I come to grasp a thing through sensation, and Aristotle is in many ways also an empiricist, when I come to grasp a thing through sensation, how do I know when I have the essence unless I know what the essence is before I go through this process of scraping off or abstraction? Mm-hmm. And so abstraction is just, on Althusser's account, a covering over of the fact that I have already in advance posited what's essential here. And mm-hmm. lo and behold, there I found it in this process of abstraction. And I think this is his main critique, what he calls their empiricism. But it also is a critique of idealism, and I think it's also comes close to a critique of new materialism.
Mm-hmm. That's really helpful. I mean, while you were speaking, of course, I was thinking about the example you invoke previously about race and what, when we perceive an individual or encounter a person, what are essential and inessential characteristics, and what might also be carried forward as essentialisms in constructing a politics. So I wondered whether, I mean, because part of my sense also of what Althusser is doing in the book is, I mean, in a sense, he sets up the discussion of Marx and exchange value, which we're about to go to on to discussing. But I wondered whether you also thought that that was a kind of political bite.
I hadn't thought about that, but you're bringing up that example I used earlier. I think what it does well is it illustrates this normative moment that Althusser wants to isolate, namely the essentialism that frequently operates in relation to race and racial categories is precisely this normative operation that is required in order for me then to locate what's not essential versus what is essential. And that normative moment, I wouldn't characterize it as ethical because I don't think it has the good in mind. Mm-hmm. I think it is more, as you put it, it is an overtly political normative moment. Mm-hmm. And I think that example shows really well what I found most helpful in Althusser.
Mm. No, I'll definitely need to go back to looking at that text. Now, what's very important in your thinking of the distinction or the alterity of thought and matter is Marx's method for maintaining a separation between thought and matter, and where the real is not presented immediately. I think this is really important. So what mediation of matter is philosophically acceptable, and how do we judge this? That seems to be one of the key questions that you address, and you address that through Marx.
There is a secret behind my reading of Marx that I may have mentioned on our own podcast, but if not, I think I'm announcing here for the first time, namely that whenever I read Marx and whenever I write on Marx, I am always attempting to rescue Marx from Engels. Engels, in particular, that I want to rescue Marx from, and this is really relevant to your question, is the Engels who is a really brute and straightforward materialist in all aspects. His theory of knowledge is materialist. His theory of history is materialist. His theory of science is materialist. And I think Marx is not a materialist in the same way at all that Engels is, and certainly not a straightforward one. And I find most helpful in showing this a discussion that Marx has in an introduction he wrote to the Contributions for the Critique of Political Economy that often, both in German and in English, is published as part of or an appendix to the Grundrisse. Mm-hmm. In there, Marx goes through the method that he himself pursues. He argues, as you sort of outlined, that the objects we encounter in sensation or in our everyday experience, the ones that we want to say are immediate because there they are, they're just given to me and I see them just like that without having to think about them or have any other relation to them, they are in fact not immediate because they are the result of a series of conditions and constituting acts and political gestures and social structures that present them to us as the objects they are. To give you an example, or it's Marx's example, many political economists want to start their discussions with population. Mm-hmm. And That's because what could be more concrete than looking at the population of, at the time, England or today the United Kingdom or the United States? Then we can count them up. We could see what their productive capacities are and so on and move on from there. But as anyone who's familiar with Marx might already be suspicious of, population is not a brute fact that's given to us immediately, because it is always given to us as already socially divided and divided by class. And so you can't talk about population without talking about class. But notice now, a person is someone I could meet on the street. A class is not something I could ever meet on the street. Although I should say today, as we're recording, this is May Day, which was invented in Chicago. The first May Day happened in Chicago. And there, maybe during the first May Day general strike, you could have met class on the street. but those days, I think, I mean, these days you don't meet, there's not, a, like race, class is not a thing that one meets in the world. And yet Marx wants to say, it's crucial in the constitution of this thing that does appear to us as if it were immediate, namely population. And so he develops this method, as he says, that thought has to rise to the level of the concrete. Mm-hmm. In other words, and this goes in direct opposition, I think, to new materialists, the concrete, the material, is not given to us immediately, but thought has to engage in a certain critical methodology in order to see the ways in which the very objects around us are in fact constituted by non-material structures and movements and processes.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is particularly helpful when we think about how there are normative regimes that mediate these categories. So, for example, how law can operate hierarchically in relation to facts, for example.
Yeah.
And mediation of matter can also be the root of the latter's negation and destruction. So the attentiveness to that mediation is precisely what Marx, I think, very helpfully enabled. And then you go on to explain in the book how Marx exposes the ghost-like objectivity of abstraction in the equivalences that enable exchange, and that these equivalences or identities, to connect this to Adorno, who will be coming up next in our discussion, that these equivalences are in fact abstractions, and they're not identical to the thing in the world. And this non-identity is a ghost-like phenomenon that haunts the process of exchange.
Yeah, and that phrase, ghost-like objectivity, is Marx's own. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a wonderful expression. And if you read Volume 1 of Capital, it is really interesting how Marx returns over and over again to the notion that capitalism, well, starting with capital, but also capitalism, is based on what he at one point calls theological positions and metaphysical niceties, theological abstractions and metaphysical niceties. And then here he talks about how exchange value is a ghost-like objectivity. And what he really wants to show throughout Volume 1 of Capital is the way in which capitalism itself operates on the basis of the reality of things that aren't material. And exchange value is just but the most basic one. You know, as Marx analyzes it there, things have a value insofar as they're useful to us, but that usefulness depends on their qualities, right? We're back to now the essential and the accidental. Leather is useful to me because it has the quality that it could repel water from my feet or my head. Or corn is useful to me because it has the qualities of being edible and has calories, and so on. So the use value we could tie directly to what he calls the sensuous characteristics of the thing. He recognizes that insofar as each commodity has these sensuous characteristics, they are so remarkably different from one another. Once we get into a situation of exchange, exchange requires that they are, in fact, not different from each other, that they are equivalent or maybe metaphysically identical. But here again, we have another scraping operation, right? We have another abstraction. So that now the corn and the leather have a value, and it's the same value, and so therefore they are the same. They are identical, but only on the basis of this process of abstraction. And yet that exchange value is a real thing that's out there and walks among us these days in the form of you know, dollars or pounds or euros. But we confront those as if they are real things. But in one way, they are abstract nothingnesses that don't exist. And yet Marx sees that they are crucial in order for understanding how we societies have material relations, individuals in societies have material relations with one another, how those societies relate to their material world, their environment, their Umwelt, as you talk about, to unpack that very concrete and very material operation of something like capitalism, one needs to trace out these abstract nothingnesses that are nonetheless real. And and so, like, the abstractness is what he refers to as their ghost-like character, and then their realness is what he refers to as objectivity.
And what you do with this analysis of the ghost-like objectivity is that you combine it with Adorno's thinking of negative dialectics. Now, Adorno is a philosopher that I have found notoriously difficult and sometimes quite obscure. So I think you need to explain this to dummies like me. how does this process of identification and non-identity become part of the identity thinking that Adorno is also addressing in negative dialectics?
We have, I think, all the tools on the table to then just draw out a conclusion from this. If we go back to Althusser,
but we should know that it is May Day and it should be tools. Tools should be down, but the tools, but the tools are on the table.
Tools should be down, right?
Yes.
But you know, the whole May Day movement was about giving everyone time to do what you and I are doing right
Absolutely.
Now. So yeah. Your tools should not be used on the floor, factory floor. That's for sure.
Okay, very good distinction.
So we just need to draw the conclusion. Starting from Althusser, we saw this abstraction, the scraping off of all of the accidental characteristics so one could get at what is essential. And a similar, we saw that abstraction now carried out, one might say, in the real world, in very concrete ways, every time commodities are exchanged on the basis of their equivalence. And I think Adorno would say that means also identity, right? In some ways, the corn and the leather are identical. What Adorno recognizes is that...
Sorry, just to clarify, when you say they're identical, do you mean they're potentially identical in a process of exchange? They're not actually, you know, they're not identical in real terms. They're identical in this process of abstraction.
Right. So while I can make shoes out of leather, corn cob shoes are not quite as efficient.
The new couture.
but I think it's worth pointing out that there is a way in which Marx's analysis of capitalism will continually point out they are really the same in all the ways that matter for capitalist societies.
Right.
And that in an odd sort of way, in capitalist societies and then in so-called late capitalist societies, all the aspects of the two things that are not identical become less and less relevant to us. And, you know, until we can abstract away all materiality and then we're just dealing with pure value of some sort or another. And Adorno wants to point out that, in fact, this stripping away of all of the things that make individuals individuals to get at what is essential to them is, as Althusser pointed out, gets at what is thinkable in the things and strips away everything that is not able to be conceptualized and thought and known. And what is then seen as the reality is really just the element in the thing that is thinkable. And Adorno sees this as the mode of operation of philosophy in the West from Aristotle onward, namely to consider as real only that which is thinkable in things. And that identity between thought and thing is what Adorno refers to as identitarian philosophy or identity philosophy. Mm-hmm. It's just the notion that thought and thing are identical.
Right. Adorno's thinking on the commodity, and I think a particularly helpful phrase or word you use is the fungibility of commodity in identity philosophy. How does this thought come to owe a debt to what you refer to as the factical? There's a sort of sense in which the thing cannot be grasped immediately. So that immediacy isn't there. My sense is that it exposes one of the problems with the empiricism of new materialism to connect back to the early part of the conversation. And so I'm kind of interested in how the move you make through Adorno in terms of identity philosophy can be brought to bear on what new materialists are doing when, you know, if it is the case that there is a kind of strong empiricism here.
Adorno has this interesting notion of what he calls the precedence of the object over the subject or over thinking or thought. In an interesting way, so when you just say that the object has precedence over the thinking of the object, in a way that sounds like, wait, isn't that the same thing that the new materialists are saying? But the problem is, as he's outlining it, that precedence does not give me direct and immediate access to the thing. Mm-hmm. But rather, for him, we need to, as a first step, pay attention to the fact that that when we talk about thinking and thought, it's the thought of something. Thinking is always a thinking of. Mm-hmm, and, you know, to use language of a different philosophical tradition, thought has a kind of intentional structure. And for Adorno, that's just what thinking is. And so in a way, thinking is always the second step of something. It's related always. It's a relation and it's related always to something that came before it. Mm-hmm. And yet it has no access to. For him, then, the question is how to engage in a way of thinking that is attentive to that precedence of the thing that is other than thought and nevertheless the thing that thought is about, the thing that thought is reaching out toward, the thing that in a way Adorno comes to say actually gets thought going. You know, if I weren't confronted with something, then I wouldn't be thinking. And so there's always, that's what I meant when I said it's like a second moment or a relation, that something other than thought is precisely what gets thought going. It's what thought was meant to be about. For him, then the question of this method he calls negative dialectics is precisely what approach can we take to thinking such that that precedence emerges and is allowed to stay.
Why is it a negative dialectics? You know, what is the negative in negative dialectics in that process?
This is a response to Hegel, who uses a dialectical method. And for Hegel, the dialectical method operates by sort of starting out with a truth, something like knowledge comes through sensation. In Hegel's hands, the method then realizes the only way in which that claim, knowledge comes through sensation, can be true and can be grounded is, in fact, by means of its opposite, namely that knowledge does not come through sensation. Mm-hmm. And to play this simply for a moment, we could just say, obviously, the claim knowledge comes through sensation is itself something that doesn't come through sensation. It emerges only after some kind of reflection or operation on what comes through sensation. Now, for Hegel, that moment where we have this contradiction, so A and B, and they cannot both be true, propels him to see that there is, in fact, some other truth that is underlying both of those. And that leads then to a positive moment in Hegel. Mm-hmm. And then Hegel's philosophy famously runs this until we get to the grand sort of positive moment in which he says such wonderful things as the real world is as it ought to be, or history is the movement of reason toward freedom, and absolute knowledge is the identity of identity and non-identity. For Adorno, he sees that this jump to, or this move to this positive truth that's underlying this opposition is required in order for thought to maintain its identity with the object of thought. Mm-hmm. And so that's the moment that has to be refused by thought. And therefore, the opposition, and here we have the basic one between thought and object of thought, that this has to be held as an opposition. And we need to deny the move to sort of unify them in some third overarching truth.
I think now, having put all the building blocks, as it were, we have the tools and the building blocks.
We're doing a lot of work on May Day, yeah. Stuart.
So now we need some redemption, obviously. The discussion you have of the redemption and the promise of thought in the book is, I think, incredibly beautiful. It's also very densely argued. So I'd like you to sort of explain what you mean by redemption here and the promise of thought. And in discussing this, you do invoke both Adorno and Walter Benjamin, but also notions, particularly through Benjamin, of the past and of hope. So it would be really useful, I think, to also potentially concretize this discussion with an example, particularly, I think, in light of the fact that when talking about the past and hope, you refer to a fragment of Walter Benjamin's thesis on the philosophy of history. I think it's the second fragment, and the phrase that I am awaited. And so this notion of I am awaited connects the past and the present. But I want to also think about this in terms of a future anterior, in terms of the present and the future. And in a future anterior that thinks about redemption in the context of climate destruction, can we any longer think about what is awaited when in fact so much is to be destroyed? And in that context, what can we then say about redemption?
Yeah. What I find most compelling about my understanding of Benjamin's philosophy of history is that, like many theories of history around his time and subsequently, he wants to call into question the sort of linear direction of history, in the sense that we, you and I, sitting right here and right now, to a certain extent, we are the culmination of history, in the sense that it all has led here. And mm-hmm. we can look back and we could trace out that way in which it all has led here to this moment. The problem with that is, as the evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould used to say, it's a just-so story. Mm-hmm. That is, that, you know, for him, he was looking at evolutionary psychology, for example, which would talk about how, you know, humans, men are unable to be monogamous, and they will then look at the condition of our primate ancestors on the African savanna, mm-hmm. and then tell a just-so story that we mm-hmm. now get to, oh, that's why men can't be monogamous. Whereas for him, the evolutionary story is more like a bush. Mm-hmm. And bushes have, sometimes they have a central kind of stalk, but not a trunk. And mm-hmm. they have many branches that lead nowhere, and they lead off in different directions, and some are shorter and some grow longer. And what he wants to do is think about how we're not the culmination of the evolutionary tree, because there is this entire past of ancestors who left no legacy, or, you know, genetic mutations that went nowhere, and so on. Now, if I think about that in terms of history, and this is what I think Benjamin wants to do, then what I come to understand is that from any moment, given our moment right here, right now, the future can go off in infinite directions, sort of like rays of the sun. And if we think about any moment in the past, you and I right now are sitting on only one of those rays. And yet we are the result of the past. Mm-hmm. And we are the result, as I say, but I think, you know, this is more or less in Benjamin. We are on one of those rays as one of the hopes of the past. So mm-hmm. that the past was hoping for something better, right? For mm-hmm. for something to be otherwise than it is. And we are one consequence of that hope. But we're only one. And to make good on that hope, I think we have to go back to, we have to look back at the past, not just as the only possible culmination of that, but to honor it in all of these multiple directions of which we are only one. To get this, though, I've been struggling with this ever since you over email and so on have raised this. There is a way, I think, in which you could get a future anterior from this notion. Mm-hmm. But that future anterior would have to be such that, in looking back to the past, we don't take ourselves as the eternal present, mm-hmm. but that mm-hmm. in a sense, as one of the hopes of the past, we are also in some sense a caretaker mm-hmm. for the future. And so, I mean, certainly we all have our own hopes for the future, but, you know, that the world is not destroyed in our lifetime, I think, is one of the implicit hopes that our grandparents had. That they wanted us to have a better life, and part of having a better life is to have a fucking... Oh, sorry, can we swear on that?
Yeah, well, countersign is much more solemn than hotel bar sessions. But, you know, Rick, it wouldn't have been a conversation if you didn't say fuck at some point.
But then we have a home to live in.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's really helpful there is that sort of sense of, yeah, I mean, I think part of the problem with the question I was asking is also that it repeats a kind of linearity, and that the future anterior cannot be thought in terms of a linearity either. And in a sense that, you know, without centering ourselves or centering the present too much, that there is a way in which there's a point of refraction of past, present, and future. But Rick, this has been a really wonderful conversation to have with you. I found your book, The Thought of Matter, incredibly inspiring. It's made me want to go back and reread texts that I have read before. There are lots of texts that I haven't ever read, which I'm going to have to learn more about. So I'm really looking forward to doing that. We, of course, met for the first time last year in Perugia at the Phenomenology Symposium. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing you again in July in Perugia. Of course, it'll be without our dear friend Philippe. And no doubt we will talk more also about him and raise many glasses when we see each other.
For sure. Well, I appreciate your kind comments about my book. You know, we write these things and we're never quite sure whether there is an audience out there or not. So it's always nice to hear that someone is out there.
Thank you, Rick. Take care now.
Thanks, Stuart.
You've been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.